Hello, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to The Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. The Reason Podcast is where I speak with Reason luminaries Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangue Ward, and Matt Welch. Today we're going to discuss Donald Trump in Puerto Rico, the Jones Act, but before we do that, we're going to discuss the mass shooting in Las Vegas, which is an unfortunate way to kick off the week. More than 50 people were killed and over 400 injured Sunday when a gunman opened fire at a country music festival in Las Vegas. This is, according to reports, the worst mass shooting in U.S. history, and the suspect named by the Vegas sheriff is Stephen Paddock, 64, now dead. So a heinous and terrible act, and just an awful thing to contemplate. And a morbidly interesting one to watch unfold as we get reports from various outlets on what's happening and see how people react to this. Matt, when there's a shooting like this, when there's a tragedy like this, what tends to unfold in the media?
Well, thankfully, over time, we've learned at least to rapidly hit forward on that convenient list of things that you're not supposed to do in the aftermath of a big, awful news event. Doesn't really prevent people from doing it, but just sort of the checklist of don't forward information based on anonymous sources, or if a news report is saying, we haven't yet to confirm this, you know, treat it with suspicion. Find local news outlets as your primary thing. So all of that, we learn a little bit from it. You will see it constantly. The thing that I'm focusing on today, just because it kind of blew up in my Twitter feed as I was first seeing this awful news, is that people are already basically accusing each other of racism in bad faith based on the fact that I believe it was the authorities in Las Vegas, and Nick can correct me since he has a post already on this this morning, ruling this out as an act of terrorism. And so this has led people like Jamel Bowie and Glenn Greenwald and other people, Adam Serwer, to say, well, you know, funny, isn't it, how quickly we are to say that this is not terrorism when the shooter is white? And other people say that doesn't make a lot of sense, and then it's just a bad faith palooza. We don't have a fixed definition of the word terrorism. We should know this by now after 16, 17 years of this increasingly miserable 21st century of ours. Law enforcement and other people use the word terrorism in these cases to mean a lot of different things. I mean, the standard definition of the word is something along the lines of it's an act of violence against an unsuspecting civilian population in order to sow broader fear, in order to make a political point, something like that. But the way that it's often used, and I suspect that it was used this morning, and the way that it's often used even when the suspects themselves are obviously Muslim, or, you know, possibly Muslim or immigrant, is that there's no known connections at this moment to a terrorist network, which is a pretty different definition of the word. And because of that, and because our, you know, nerves are just rubbed raw as a nation when it comes to anything having to do both with terroristic violence and just with any questions of race, everyone conveniently forgets all of the murky definitions that we use for these words. I recall, as one example, and I'll stop talking in a second, very soon after 9/11, there was a shooting at the El Al desk of El Al Airlines at LAX by, I believe, an Egyptian national who went to the desk of the Israeli airline and killed him some Jews. All that the LA local political authorities and cops were saying at the time is, this is not an act of terrorism. This is not an act of terrorism. It's like, wait a second. Muslim guy got real mad and thought he'd go kill some Jews. But what they meant at that moment was, we don't have any evidence that there is a broader plot of which this is a part. And so if we can try to be gentle folk for a moment, in a moment of awfulness, don't always assume it's everyone is acting in horrendous faith here. We use different definitions of that term, and that's kind of unhelpful, but we should know this by now. We should have learned this lesson.
Well, it does tend to get politicized very, very quickly. Catherine, is there I hesitate to say, is there an etiquette, but is there something to that effect where we ought to stand back and kind of take events in before we try and launch into political diatribes? Or is that something that's justified because it's part of the national conversation?
I mean, I'm not sure who we is here
media.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're in but, media, yeah.
You know, the idea that the idea that people are going to want to have information, that they're going to turn by and large to cable news and the internet for that information, and that there just isn't information to be had for the most part in the first hours after something like this, means that there really is no good solution except to super boringly repeat like the three things that we do know, one of which will still turn out to be wrong. So there's this kind of problem of the need for insta analysis and then insta meta analysis. And I think like that's the place where it would be appropriate to say like, hey, let's not mentally reshape global policy while we're still waiting to find out what actually happened, right? You know, it's like, okay, well, we need to, this is blowback. This is, you know, we need to take all of our bases out of everywhere. And, you know, maybe just wait a hot second. That's not actually, though, super helpful advice, right? Because that's not really an option for the people who need to just say words on CNN.
Yeah, yeah. Just on a non-political level, like one of the things that is one of these rules that Nate Silver posted today on Twitter, I think, is that it's usually a lone actor. But there's also usually reports that there are multiple shooters. And that seems to be the case, that it usually is one person, yet there's a proliferation of false rumors going around. Nick, I assume that these are not meant by bad actors to throw people off, that it's just kind of a weird cognitive thing that happens when a tragedy occurs. What kind of errors do you see creeping into reports after a tragedy?
Well, first off, there's just the bad information with which Matt has talked about, where people are trying to, figure out what's going on, and they piece together things, and it's very hard to know when, kind of projections or hypotheticals are being reported as fact or not. The question about the two shooters is, it's a good one, but that actually seems kind of parenthetical to the larger issues of looking for the closest local sources that are credible, that are not just interested in being first, but also in correcting themselves as things go kind of haywire. But at places like Columbine, which in many ways was the first kind of mass shooting of the modern era, if you would, there were two shooters. So, it varies. And it was actually on the media that put out a list of things saying, like, watch for these are the buzzwords that, reports will use, where they say we're checking with sources, we're doing this, we're doing that. So, there's that. And then I think to speak to some of what Catherine's talking about, I would drill down even further to, I've already seen in a couple of news stories, or not news stories, but online, as well as in my Twitter feed and whatnot, people saying, okay, this is why we need gun control, and we have to ban machine guns, because apparently the guy was using a fully automatic weapon from a distance, which is also quite different than most of the mass shootings that we've been used to seeing, or that we've seen in the past. But, it's not clear that it was fully automatic, and automatic weapons or machine guns are actually tightly, tightly regulated at this point. So you can see how people are already going to start pushing an agenda. I think it's, that's the most basic thing, is to be human in the immediate aftermath of something, and to kind of not immediately rush to fill any space or any vacuum with your preferred activist policy that's going to be, that you could rattle off at any moment in time. But that's also part of what the news media is all about. So we have to kind of deal with that. The larger issue is also, how are we defining not just terrorism, as Matt touched on, but also mass shootings? Last year, in 2016, when there was the Orlando Pulse shooting, which up until that point had been the largest or the deadliest mass shooting, 49 people were killed there. Andrew, as you mentioned, at least 50 people have been killed in Vegas. There was already there was a discussion about mass shooting, and depending on what definition you used last year, there were either something like 130 mass shootings, or if you use a different definition, there were three. And that hinges on whether or not there were three or four people who were wounded in a single event, not counting the shooter. So we get into a discussion almost immediately about whether, you know, and this makes sense. I mean, in the same way that Hurricane Harvey and Irma and whatnot make sense, tropical storms do, you know, is this significant beyond its own tragedy? Is this part of a growing trend? Are we a more deadly society? Are we a more violent society? And you can see why people want to talk about this, because we have a lot of time to fill before the information actually comes out. And these are questions that are legitimately on our mind. And I think we should discuss them both during a tragedy and certainly after, as the facts come through a little bit more clearly. And that's when policy should be discussed. But it makes sense, you know, and it's understandable why people want to talk about certain types of things.
I also think there's a distinction that we don't make because it's harder to politicize in a lot of our statistics, but is probably a more accurate one, which is shootings where the person was shooting someone particular on purpose, and shootings where the person was just shooting people because they wanted to shoot someone. And I think that's also a distinction that you sometimes see missing from, well, first of all, from firearm statistics generally, both because we lump suicides in there and accidents, as well as homicides, in a way that people tend to pick the number that supports their case. We also see this in kidnappings, right? The distinction between children or adults who are kidnapped by strangers who seem, you know, seemingly at random or somewhat at random, versus custody incidents and the like. That's the distinction we're really trying to get at. When we say mass shooting, we mean, how worried should I be if I go to the mall that some psycho is going to shoot me up? And
right. As opposed to if you're a gang member and you're walking on another gang's turf,
right, or
with three or four of your buddies, and you get into a firefight.
Or
yeah,
how
exactly.
likely am and I to be murdered, right, just by someone
right.
who typically someone who knows me.
Yeah.
I think that distinction is what we're trying to get to, but by using the terms mass shooting and terrorism, we wind up jumping headfirst into the most politicized variant of what is actually just people trying to understand their own risk.
Yeah, as part of that, I mean, think about all. I think we still are not sure what to call the Fort Hood mass shooting act of terrorism, because the guy was shooting up his own unit. I might hopefully don't have that exactly wrong, but I mean, was it a workplace thing? Was it a jihadi thing? I tend to think it was probably.
Is it a military thing?
Part of a standard definition of terrorism is to terrorize civilian populations. So what happens when they go after the military or cops? Is that exactly terrorism? So all these definitions are super fuzzy, and people in casual conversation use them differently, and certainly law enforcement in times of stress use it differently. And not right now. I mean, Donald Trump, president of the United States, strangely enough, is going to be giving a talk about this, comments about this, beyond his tweet this morning offering warmest condolences. He's going to say something, and already my Twitter stream is like, say the word terrorism, because the left wants the white guy to be called a terrorist. And I get that. I understand that in a huge way. Like, you don't want people to use the precise language and not shy away from it. But I think also we just have to understand that in these moments of stress, everyone has a little bit of different definitions of that. So try to bring precision to it.
It should be interesting to hear how Trump is going to deal with this. And I hate to sound as detached, you know, as I guess I am, really. But, you know, because this does seem to be an event where, you know, as far as we know, so far, and the local police have said they had no contact with Paddock before this event. So it's not like he was, a well-known kind of troublemaker. He doesn't seem to have any ties to any kind of white supremacist organizations or jihadi organizations or anything like that. So it's clearly a mass shooting. It's terroristic in that, you know, anytime you're in a large gathering and somebody starts shooting a machine gun, apparently from like, a high floor in a nearby casino, from a nearby casino. This is pretty fucking scary. There's no question about that. But it's not terrorism in the way that the IRA used to blow up, you know, they blow up Francis's Tavern in New York, you know, to make a political point about, you know, the British in England in the 70s or the British in Ireland in the 70s. But, you know, Trump campaigned on explicitly on the idea that he was the law and order candidate and that we needed a law and order candidate because crime was so bad in America, especially violent crime. This is, you know, a horrific violent crime that's taking place in a backdrop of a country that where the violent crime rate is, you know, 50 points lower than it was in 1993. And, you know, it's kind of strange because, and it's happening on his watch, and it will be, to put it, you know, kind of euphemistically, it'll be interesting to see how he deals with that because, this shouldn't be happening on his watch. And it does fit what he seemed to be hearkening to, even though he was chasing after a phantom menace, because America, one of the things that is most remarkable in every major city and in, you know, throughout the country, I mean, you know, violent crime.
Can you go a little bit further in on that, Nick, in terms of gun crime? Do you have any statistics off the top of your head or just sort of general trends?
Yeah,
like, it's my understanding that gun crime is also reduced.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, so the violent victimization rates, and I'm looking at stuff that was put together by the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which there's also there's another main kind of summary, annual summary of criminal actions, and they differ a little bit, but you know, violent victimization, the rate per 1,000 people ages 12 and older, which is a marker between 1993 and 2015, dropped from about 78%, 80 incidents per person to somewhere around 20 over that period, which is, you know, pretty stunning. And then when you look at
I hope it's not actually 80 incidents per person.
No, that would be, I mean, you know, that's for sure.
I don't know what kind of life you're living,
yeah,
Gillespie,
no,
but.
Yeah, it's certainly not.
It's like a crime
and,
drama.
Firearm violence, the firearm victimization rate between 1993 and 2015, and again, these are the rates per person, went from about 7.5% down to about 1.5%. So, you know, what we're talking about here is a, you know, a freaking enormous, almost uninterrupted decline. There were brief ticks up in the late, in like 2005, 2006. Even over the past couple of years where we've talked about increases in crime, according to the BJS statistics, which again are a little bit different than the National Criminalization or Victimization Study, which uses a different methodology and has seen a slight uptick in crime, but like they're still flat. So, you know, we have dropped crime, firearm crime and violent crime almost to zero, and it's not showing any sign of an uptick. So that's good news. It's clear, and if you talk to criminologists or you research this, they have some pretty good ideas of why that's happening, but not really good ones. Like, nobody is exactly clear, and it's clear it's not simply different types of policing habits, although that might be some of it. It's clearly it's not because the economy is great, because the economy has been shitty through, you know, for the past 15 years or sideways. You know, it's not clear, you know, why this is happening all over the country. And the only places where you see upticks, places like Chicago, it's very clearly related to criminal gang activity. And it's within most of the people who are being victimized are other gang members. So it's a curious reality that we kind of immediately incorporate into the status quo without thinking about it until something like this happens. And then oftentimes, instead of seeing these as kind of odd events, we see these as somehow indicative of everyday life, when in fact they're incredibly, you know, outlying.
Well, and we've talked about this before. It's not just a weird thing that has happened where we obsess about, you know, aggressively cover, attempt to extract lessons from violence in a world where violence is declining. It's because we are trying to process what it means to live in a world where violence is declining, and because individual incidents of violence are not present in our everyday lives. When we see something, either on television or in real life, but increasingly on television, feels like we are seeing it in our own real lives, it's more striking and more upsetting. I think, you know, the fact that we will all spend the next week and a half trying to make sense of what happened in Vegas. Now, it's a pretty big shooting, so it would have happened at any time that we would have obsessed about it to some extent. But, you know, in a world where shootings are increasingly rare, we have to spend more time thinking about and processing one when it happens.
Well, you know, Catherine, can I ask you or Matt as well, like from a libertarian point of view, what do we need to be talking about differently? Because, you know, on a certain level, and I hate to put it in these terms, but we have kind of the facts on our hand. It's clear that gun control laws have been liberalized for the past 20 years over the exact time period that there has been less gun crime. And some people would say there's a connection there, you know, going back to the old Robert Heinlein, Bill Burroughs line about an armed society is a polite society. But, you know, it's clear that, like, we're not going to win any more converts to the idea that the number of guns in circulation or the number of guns that people are legally allowed to carry and own and, you know, put ammunition in is not, you know, the more guns there are in circulation, it certainly doesn't increase the amount of crime. But in these kinds of circumstances, it seems to me like that basic argument is not really going to be very convincing to many people. And is there a way that we take a kind of libertarian message of allowing individuals to arm themselves the way they want, you know, in a new direction to convince people in the light of incidents like this?
Well, the policy argument is going to be about the extent to which this was a semi-automatic or automatic weapon, and whether or not this guy who apparently has no criminal record, although we'll maybe find out that piece of thing is wrong. So I think that's where the policy argument goes, and usually it goes to background checks as well. I think one thing that we're always good for in these moments, and I say this as a genuinely good faith thing to my friends who want to limit guns, is they need to start from the basics on the ground, which is that there is an individual right to armed self-defense in this country. It was recognized in 2008, incorporated in all the states in 2010. That's done. We have more than 300 million guns in this country. It is clearly a cultural, societal interest to be armed. I think one in three households is estimated to have guns. And it's really hard to sort through that. I recommend everyone read Brian Dougherty's incredible piece from about a year and a half ago about how most of what you think you know about gun social science is wrong, and he really pours through as much of the research as he can, and it's very, very difficult to do, but it's a great starting point. But in order to get to where people want to go, and I mean the gun controllers want to go, they need to seed that reality first. What I find increasingly is kind of similar to the abortion debate. Once this thing gets decided as the big question on the national level and the Supreme Court weighs in and that's it, we're going to have abortion in this country. We just are. We're going to have guns as an individual right in this country. We just are. Then the losing side of that starts to detach more from reality and get into a more kind of biblical, the other side is evil type of thing. In fact, the 2008 Heller decision, or the McDonald decision, I get them confused, Heller, includes a lot of local leeway for variation on gun regulations. Certainly, I live in New York City. Like, it's really hard to do anything with a gun or to own a gun in this city. I think there's only one place that you can take your gun to practice shooting and all this kind of stuff. That was written into the decision, that there can be a lot of variance, including on semi-automatics and muzzles and background checks and all these types of things. So the place where actual policy is going to be debated and is being fought is on the local level with those types of variances, and will be fought in this case as well. But, you know, there's a great recent TV video about a year ago, I want to say, after one of the last mass shootings, I believe it was Austin Bragg who put it together, of like, okay, so you want to do it like Australia? Sure, which is, you know, they confiscated people's guns. There's a lot of simplistic approaches to what, you know, what we need to do. Adam Gopnik, the New Yorker writer, has said that, you know, we know exactly what to do to curb gun violence just as much as we know that the polio vaccine cures polio. We just lack the will to do it. And so Austin Bragg went through, okay, this is what it would look like if you actually went through this. So as a long-winded way of answering your question, Nick, is like, let's just get the policy debate tethered in the reality that we live in. And part of that reality, and I want to Twist a little bit of what Nick said. Nick, you said the gun violence is getting close to zero. That's a little bit too much. I mean, we still have more gun violence in this country than just about anywhere in the industrialized West. And that's part of the ongoing puzzle. It's just that it is indeed way the hell down. I was at a law enforcement dinner last week, and the commissioner of New York police said that shootings in New York year over year are down more than 100%, which is insane to me. So
is that possible?
It doesn't seem to be possible, no, but those are the words that came out of his mouth. So I'm just passing along inaccurate knowledge from the source. So let's just tether it to reality and go from there is, I think, always a good source. I don't see this as the moment to do what Peter Bagg did in a great recent cover story, which is talk about the right to own a bazooka. That's not necessarily the winning. It's a great thing to talk about in many times, and that's maybe someone else's argument. But to get to any kind of rational policy agreement, let's actually talk about the world that we live in and are going to live in, and even doing that, you're going to be peeling back 90% of the kind of overheated crap that you hear in the wake of these things.
This is the trouble, though, with almost every controversial issue, is to try and be a realist is to sound like a denialist or a Pollyanna at the best case. To say the reason that we are flipping out about incidents of racial bias every time we see one is because they are way down. The reason we are flipping out about incidents of gun violence is because they are way down. The reason that we're... And it's very, very, I feel like I have never figured out how to strike the right tone. I think it's so important to say that thing, to inject that into the debate. Don't panic because this is rare. It just feels like a big deal because this is rare. And, you know, that's never going to land on hospitable ears in moments like this one.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, when it comes to things like airplane crashes or even railroad crashes, which happen very infrequently, partly because people don't travel that much, or car crashes, we seem more able to do that. You don't hear about, I guess airline crashes are virtually, you know, they almost, I guess to borrow the statistical method of the New York police commissioner, they almost don't happen, so that when they do, you know, it seems we don't even notice really anymore. We just accept it as a kind of one-off. I'm not exactly sure, why it's different with mass shootings. And it might be that they're more frequent. I mean, again,
because it feels fixable. Yeah. It's because of this phenomenon of, like, we know how to solve this. It feels fixable fixable than stopping, you know, highway or plane or train travel.
Right. Again, which are also, I mean, highway, you know, it, I mean, one of the things that is odd is that now people, and this goes to Catherine, something Catherine was saying, you know, there's 30,000 some homicides by firearm in a given year, typically, and more than half of those are suicides. So, you know, now people say, now that it used to be, when we would talk about traffic fatalities, I remember people saying more people die every year in car accidents than Americans died in Vietnam, because there was a long period of time where they were in the high 50,000 a year range. And now that traffic fatalities are down in the 20s or something, you hear this, you know, they get used as the normalizing factor in talking about gun violence, which itself then, if you strip out accidents and and suicides, you're looking, you know, you're in the teens really, or in the low 20s. And it becomes very bizarre in how, like, last years or last decades, last generations, scare facts that were used to make cars safer, now car fatalities are being used to make gun deaths seem more scary, even if they're declining, you know, as a percentage. So it gets kind of confusing in many ways.
All that is true, but I mean, the four biggest gun mass shootings in American history have happened in the last 10 years. I mean, that's a thing. Five out of the biggest six have happened in the last 10 years. So there is that thing which is increasing. There's a lethality of the events that is increasing. And I think that's what people are responding to. And it's perfectly correct to point that out as well.
Well, and I think to get into the kind of cognitive things that happened, I think the position that everybody here is adopting, which is let's look at the numbers and kind of figure out what's happening in a realistic, grounded sense, is a very difficult one to communicate in an issue that's incredibly visceral. So when I'm talking to friends and family back in Oklahoma and something about terrorism comes up, something like that, one of the things I oftentimes point out is that we should personally be way more worried about diabetes where I'm from statistically than we should about most of these other things. But it's so much more gripping and visceral to deal with mass shootings that are going to spread in terms of media content much more than any type of number is going to happen. I'm curious, Nick. You brought up that laws have been liberalized, and as a result, or at least as a correlation, that homicides are down. Are there any laws that you would like to see further implemented that you think would aid in terms of declining gun violence?
That's a pretty good question. I don't know. The one thing I was going to bring up that Jacob Solomon pointed out last year after the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, which again had been the deadliest mass shooting until this one, and did have a terrorism component. The guy who shot there was Muslim, and he did actually leave phone messages claiming to be an affiliate or motivated by ISIS and Islamic jihadi rhetoric and thoughts. But that people always think about mass shootings in terms of automatic or semi-automatic weapons. Jacob Solem had written that in something like 2/3 of known mass shooting incidents, as counted by Mother Jones, which uses a very loose definition, so the numbers are higher. But in 2/3 of those, the weapons were firearms, and that they tend to be rather lower kind of caliber and not even necessarily semi-automatic. So you get that right away. I think, one of the things that we need to think about, and this is something I remember reading an article in Reason about this before I even worked here. So it was sometime in the late 80s or early 90s, about how there has never been a particularly strong correlation between the number of weapons in circulation and rates of crime. And that actually holds true internationally, where you'll have countries that have relatively high rates of gun ownership and relatively high rates of crime with guns, and the opposite, and every possible variation on that. So I don't know, but I do think, as a rule of thumb, that the way laws are structured now, and I think this is true in places like Chicago, the laws only function to keep arms out of the hands of people who might benefit from actually having them as a means of defense. So, gang members and police, they have guns, and they're going to get them legally in one hand, in one case, and illegally in another. And it's actually people who might use them in self-defense, or where the threat of people breaking into your house or just bashing on somebody walking down the street because they're pretty sure they're unarmed, because that's the official policy of a city. I think liberalizing gun ownership laws and carry laws in particular are always a good thing, because I think that to the extent that there's a logic you can parse out, criminals in general are less likely to attack people. They respond to incentives like most human beings do, or like all other human beings. And if you raise the cost of committing criminal activity, if you try and mug somebody and they have a gun and they might shoot you, you're less likely to do that. I find that logic pretty compelling.
The one thing that we can do that would have the most impact on reducing gun crime in this country, and I don't think that it would be particularly close, is to end the war on drugs. That the guns are used in commission of people who are in the commission of crimes, or even in the case of legal medical marijuana people who can't use banks. They're just got hefty bags full of cash that they got to take from place to place. You're going to defend that thing with a gun, and the other people are going to try to prey on you. This almost never gets brought up, and libertarians are seen as crazy people for bringing it up. But if you really want to end gun crime, there was a lot of gun crime in the 1930s or 1920s, I should say. Al Capone got married in a church down the street from where I'm talking to you right here. There's a hell of a lot of gun crime around these parts back then, associated with prohibition. If you want to be serious about it, do that. And that's actually within the likelihood within the realm of possibility, I think, more than is some kind of fantasy of replicating what countries like Australia have done with gun confiscation.
And it wasn't really confiscation. I mean, there were buyback programs, et cetera. But I think you're right, Matt. I mean, obviously, de-escalating the war on drugs. And it's even easier than that because it's really just getting rid of the war on pot. And you will get rid of that's where use of drugs is heavily concentrated, and that's where a lot of policing efforts go. So if you get rid of that, you will get rid of what the drug that most people use that is now pushed into black market status, which brings violence with it.
Here's the thing, though, right? We're here. We're a bunch of libertarians sitting around talking on a podcast, and we're like, okay, just get rid of the war on drugs, and this doesn't happen, right? Which, yes, first of all, you guys could not be more right. Fuck yeah. But also, this feels like why this conversation can't go anywhere. And, you know, to say, listen, it would be great if when there's a sales dispute over marijuana, that could be resolved in an incredibly boring and moderately expensive judicial arbitration process instead of by shooting each other. Yes. A plus to that. But it feels, I worry that us saying this stuff sounds to, you know, the people who are the kind of confiscatory gun controllers just as sort of misguided and off topic. I mean, how do you bridge that gap? And it feels to me like the place to talk about it is this, you know, statistical likelihood, you know, is crime really up, zone? But that seems tricky, too. I mean, I just want to kind of flag, yes, you're right, but Jesus Christ,
well observed, Catherine, for sure. Yeah. Then to start out saying, you know, we shouldn't be using these tragedies to start foisting our, you know, our preferred policy positions, which, you know, I wake up.
And then 5 minutes later, we're like, legalize heroin.
Yeah, I wake up every day saying, like, you know, just if we could have vending machines, you know, think of, you know, the vending machines that could sell heroin now. They're not even the old cigarette machines where you got to pull the rod out and stuff like that. You know, they have that whole little, you know, kind of mousetrap thing where the heroin packet will come down and roll down a bunch of things and make a guy who's about to dive into a water hole spring forward and then bring it down in a nicely, you know, packaged little baggie. That would be kind of great.
That was a very detailed fantasy.
Thank you.
Catherine, I want to do a quick follow-up with you before we move on to another topic. I think you're right in that the truth in these matters is found in the data and looking at it calmly and empirically, but the ability to communicate that is negligible. No one ever wants to sit down and look at a graph. People want to, you know, be able to emotionally lash out at something. And I'm going to have to wade onto Twitter here in a few minutes, and I'm not looking forward to it. And it's not going to have any type of calm discussion. How do you bridge that of being able to reach people that are looking for something visceral and emotional when your impulse is to rationally
view the
situation?
You guys are going to laugh at me because this is the opposite of my usual MO. But this is, I feel like, a place where empathy is the relevant factor. And this sort of we published years ago now in Reason an excerpt from a book by Michael Shermer, who essentially posited that along with the Flynn effect, which is where people are getting smarter and smarter, where our IQs are actually increasing over time, we may be experiencing that due to an increase in empathy, that we see other people as part of our in-group rather than our out-group, and that circle expands and gets bigger. And I think that's ultimately kind of the reason why violent crime is down. This is also in Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. Violent crime is down because we don't see nearly as many of the people who are just milling around us day to day as essentially, you know, animals worthy of destruction or mortal enemies. So I feel like the answer to how do you talk about this in an emotionally literate way is this, like, hippy dippy empathy answer to say, like, yeah, it's great that we're trying to understand why we see the white shooter as us and not a terrorist and the Muslim shooter as them and a terrorist or something like that. So in that sense, I think maybe it is the right discussion. But to sort of overall say people are getting better and better at treating each other well, we should be proud of humanity for that. So don't worry about this mass shooting. Still is like, not quite there.
I have actually been, I was just going to say very quickly, I am actually checking Twitter, and ISIS has actually claimed responsibility for the Paddock shooting, which either is a sign that maybe we jumped too soon because Stephen Paddock was a non-Muslim, non-Arab-looking, non-Middle Eastern-connected man or immigrant, or that many of the claims made by ISIS for various kinds of random acts of horrible violence might be overblown. So, you know, but I, you know, to go back to some of the stuff we were talking about earlier, it's like there's still a lot of basic knowledge that, you know, and facts that have not come out yet. Matt, sorry.
So Nick, like, stole my thunder there. I was going to cut in. But the other thing I was going to say is...
Wait, did you say it sounds like thunder? Are you going to... Are we talking about Bob Seger now and the Silver Bullet Band?
We're always talking about Bob Seger, Nick. There's not a moment where we're not talking about Bob Seger. No, the other thing I just wanted to point out is that, to be clear, what Catherine is saying is that other people should talk in an empathetic way because she lacks the ability to do that herself.
Well, you know, it's true, though, and it really is, you know, that kind of expanding circle of humanity, which I, you know, and again, not to, I guess, well, I guess I am hijacking this to libertarian ends, but that's the basis of the liberal enlightenment, and the idea of universality of humans and of human behavior. And it's hard to recapture, but I think it's worth doing, especially in an era of like really kind of revived tribalism. You know, part of tribalism is that those other people, however we define an outgroup, they're not like us and they don't respond to the same cues. And I hate to quote, I think about this often, the horrible Sting song, where he asks, you know, or where he suggests that Russian parents love their children too, because at the height of the Cold War, near the end of the Cold War, that was actually, you know, kind of, you know, we would often lose sight of that, and vice versa, and things like that. And but that liberal, you know, that classical liberal value, and Steven Pinker's next book is called Enlightenment Now, and it's kind of a very explicit defense of the foundational ideas of the Enlightenment, which include things like rationality and freedom of expression and empathy and a sense of universal human rights and citizenship in the world. And it's, you know, we live in an age now where Trump and many of his supporters are attacking globalists, and they often mean people who will say, you know what, like, we have some responsibility to the people in the Middle East whose lives I don't think I'm responsible for all the fucked up shit in the Middle East, but I do know that American foreign policy for the past 15 years, if not the past 50 or 75 years, has really fucked things up there or helped to. Like, we should feel empathy with them, and we should act on that. And one of the effects of it, as I think Catherine was saying, is that it de-escalates violence in a much more personal or domestic setting as well. It is a value, and it's a change, and it's, you know, it's something that we should, you know, both note, celebrate, try to extend further and faster.
Well, you all have actually managed to elevate my mood a little bit beyond where I was at the beginning of the podcast, and I agree with you on all these points. I think that empathy is a good and necessary thing in these situations, and I very much like where you guys are at in terms of in-groups and out-groups. One of the frustrating things for me, working in political media, is I don't view myself as an opponent with most of the people that I'm interacting with. I see us kind of working on common problems. But I find that is not typically the view if I'm doing a political panel where the idea is that we're all enemies and we're trying to prevail over the sin and error of the other people there.
I like the idea that the Reason podcast is just your audio Prozac. We're here for you, Heaton, and other listeners.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, that my
thank
my,
you.
Yeah, my main, you know, now that my kids are almost fully grown, Andrew, I've been looking for another project, and I'm glad that we're able to bind your psychic wounds.
Nick, I think if we don't make me that test case, and you and I go play catch, I think you could probably auction off Nick's new parenting experiment to the Reason audience and see who would be interested in doing
and
it.
I'm giving you fair warning.
We're going to go full Philip Larkin in a minute.
I'm giving you fair warning, and Matt knows this from a personal experience, but when I throw a high pop-up for you to catch, Andrew, you just watch out because you're about to get hit in the crotch with a fastball.
All right, noted. Good. Well, that's the perfect note to conclude our mass shooting discussion on. But I do want to cover Puerto Rico because it is a relevant thing in the news cycle, and it's what was dominating the news up until last night, sadly.
And it's one of those areas that you have not yet been able to find it in your heart to extend your empathy.
That's right.
To.
My empathy is only for the continental United States. I feel no empathy for Alaska, Hawaii.
We can tell, Andrew, because you said it wrong. We all have to say it now, Puerto Rico. You have to get really authentic.
You know, I'm gonna weigh in on that. I don't like it when people. I think you can do that if you do it with everything, because sometimes people will correct me on like Nevada as opposed to Nevada, and my response is, do you say the capital of England is London? Like you have to, you know, if you're gonna do it, go all the way.
I would like you to go all the way.
Yeah, are we supposed to? That means we say English words like Rulalenska, the wonderful TV star.
Don Quixote. Yeah, you could do that. Okay. I give you permission to do that.
There are cases where the like Byron's Don Juan poem, the Don Juan poem.
Don Juan.
You know, it is actually it's a two syllable name though, in the way that he wrote it, and it matters to the rhyme scheme because there was not the Juan in English when he was writing it.
That's true.
It's very confusing. Very confusing.
I am enjoying the speed with which we are moving through topics right now.
This is the longest, but I think best transition that we've ever had. But I'm gonna cut it off and go ahead and jump in. So, over the weekend, President Trump tweeted a series of sort of inflammatory and insensitive comments about the Puerto Rican government's response to Puerto Rico. So Puerto Rico has been racked by Hurricane Maria. I think a massive amount of the island is without power. A significant portion of the island is without water. So there's a large humanitarian crisis going on. Some of the tweets that Trump said in response to this were, such poor leadership ability by the mayor of San Juan and others in Puerto Rico who are not able to get their workers to help. They want everything to be done for them when it should be a community effort. 10,000 federal workers now on island doing a fantastic job. And then one of the big ones, Texas and Florida are doing great, but Puerto Rico, which was already suffering from broken infrastructure and massive debt, is in deep trouble. And then he topped this off on Sunday by attending a golf game in New Jersey and dedicating the trophy to the victims of the hurricane, which many people have viewed as a somewhat glib response to it. I don't know how well the federal government or Trump have been doing in terms of actually intervening and assisting in Puerto Rico. I have no data set that I could use for that. But the progressive narrative is very much Trump is doing nothing and has been doing nothing, and his incompetency is willfully killing people. Catherine, is that a fair assessment?
You know, I've been following some of the Puerto Rico fallout purely through the Twitter feed of Lin-Manuel Miranda, who is the creator of Hamilton and of Puerto Rican extraction. So, if he is to be believed, Donald Trump is like single-handedly, preventing the power stations from getting up and running just because he's a huge dick. So there's like that end of the spectrum where he literally said, you know, you're going straight to hell to the president. I hate to say this, as I always do, but I think Donald Trump is a little bit right here that the difference between how Texas is recovering and how Puerto Rico is recovering is because of underlying infrastructure and resource availability problems. And yeah, the Gulf Trophy thing was just totally tone deaf. We unfortunately now will be spending the next week talking about this mass shooting instead of the kind of legitimate ongoing humanitarian problems in all the places that have been hit by these different hurricanes. But, to say out loud, gee, Puerto Rico is struggling because Puerto Rico's standard of living was lower before this started is true. And to me, it's just, it's further evidence for the that I was right all along. It's further evidence for the Ron Bailey theory that economic development is the best bulwark against environmental threats.
It's also important to point out that Trump is just being a super big dick about all of this stuff.
He really is. It's
to insult, criticize a mayor. And the mayor might be terrible, and she might have been lippy, and she was wearing a shirt, saying, make something like, help us, we're dying out here, on CNN. But to criticize a mayor in real time, who's like swimming through feces, in a place that's just wrecked, it's bad judgment, bad taste. He did something similar in the London terrorist attack, right? He went, started talking
smack. Yeah, he went off on the mayor, yeah.
On the mayor there. That's just not how you do it. And he personalizes everything as if like, oh, they're running down my troops and the Democrats told her to attack Trump and all this kind of stuff. It's just really unseemly. I saw any number of conservatives, Eric Erickson, Charles C.W. Cook, just tons of people out there saying, you know, I was thinking about defending this, but Jesus Christ, just stop it already. And that's true. I mean, at some point, by which I mean every single week, there is evidence for the fact that this is kind of a bad person who is the president, and that sucks. It's really too bad. It's also not a reason to lose your freaking mind and go full Keith Olbermann, who's accusing him of deliberate genocide in Puerto Rico. Even what's his name, Russ Honoré, who led the crisis in management in Hurricane Katrina in the aftermath there, has already gone like full Kanye on Trump and saying it's because he doesn't care about non-white people. That's kind of hard to judge as far as I'm concerned. Kind of it's just difficult to judge those things. I'm not sure it makes anything better, but certainly on just kind of an interpersonal level, Trump's performance has been awful. I've seen one comparison that raised my eyebrows, which is the comparison to the amount of logistical support that the U.S. brought to Haiti in the aftermath of the earthquake there in 2010, I believe it was, and the logistical support that we brought into Puerto Rico. And there's a Washington Post TikTok, as they say, about the Trump administration's response that doesn't look too great. However, I just I don't like the instant expertise that everybody has in assessing disaster relief. It is a super big logistical problem to send that many people out there and like try to get a grid working and all
these
kinds of things.
Well, it's also with the comparison between Haiti and Puerto Rico. It's worth pointing out that there's a difference between an earthquake and a series of storms, which continue to make things difficult to get to and to bring resources to. With certain reservations, because I think you're right. Both Andrew and Matt are right that Trump is just, he's a dick. I mean, he's a really horrible human being who has an uncanny knack for saying exactly the worst thing at the worst possible moment. But to kind of support Catherine's point, none of that actually is at play here, because Trump's words aren't the problem in Puerto Rico. And there are a couple of ways to think about this, and it's worth thinking about it in terms of the response in Louisiana to Hurricane Katrina, which is that at the local level and at the state level, government did not respond well. They knew what was coming. They had years to prepare, and they just fucking didn't do it. And then the federal government fucked up as well in its response, both in the immediacy, in the immediate response, and then the longer term stuff. And to his credit, Trump does not see, he has not fucked up, the Houston relief to the degree that FEMA is involved, the federal agency, and in a couple of other instances. And Puerto Rico does, on some level, it has to own, the fact that they are not, they have not responded well to this. And you are never going to be able to solve longstanding systemic problems with a good, with a good performance in one moment or something like that. Having said that, the federal government has not acted well towards Puerto Rico as a commonwealth. And, there are all sorts of issues. And, Puerto Rico is split between people who want full statehood and other people who don't. There are many arguments on both sides. I can't begin to pretend even to be able to kind of figure those out in any way. But it is true that the federal government and, most clearly through the Jones Act, which we are going to be talking about, which is a piece of protectionist shipping legislation that dates back to 1920. There are even older laws that are set up to help the interests of kind of mainland American shipping, a domestic shipping industry, that are all in place that screw over Puerto Rico, as well as a wide variety of other federal laws and federal mandates and strictures on what Puerto Rico can and cannot do. And it's not to say Puerto Rico isn't responsible.
Like the minimum wage.
I mean, it's just
I think the minimum wage is a really big one. The Puerto Rico, the median income is poorer than the poorest state in the union, the poorest state in the union. So it's having a minimum wage there is just kills.
And
any
I
type
mean,
of
this
employment.
Is where you know, and these are harder things to do because if you're the mayor of San Juan, or if you're Donald Trump, or if you're a supporter or a defender, you know, if you're a millionaire from writing the Broadway show that's defining, you know, American theater for the next 20 years, it's easy to point to one thing and say, oh, this person is the problem. But in fact, it's much more complicated than that. And the Jones Act in particular, which makes it vastly more expensive for American citizens, and Puerto Ricans are American citizens, they're full American citizens, you know, it makes it much more expensive and much more isolating to live there, even though Puerto Rico is closer to New York than most of, you know, like than the West Coast of America. You know, that's kind of fucked up and we should be looking into that.
Yeah. And Trump, he did waive the Jones Act, but it took him a while.
Only after saying he loves the Jones Act. The Jones Act is great legislation, and I'm not going to be waiving it, you know, it simply because of this disaster, which happens from various, you know, in various moments. It's good that he did. But, you know, the problem is the Jones Act, or one major problem for Puerto Rico and actually for people everywhere. It's, I mean, the Jones Act essentially forces anybody living on an island that is a U.S. property or state to have to go through U.S. flagships, which raises costs prohibitively on all sorts of, you know, basic goods and services that you're going to get. It's and again, it goes back to 1920 when the globe was very different and the American shipping industry, shipbuilding as well as actual merchant marine stuff, was very different. It would be like, you know, it would be saying, I mean, we wouldn't stand for that if we still had the same import quotas and tariffs at their maximums going back 100 years. You know, we'd be pissed, and we ought to be getting rid of that.
We ought to be getting rid of that. John McCain has a new proposal with, I believe, Mike Lee to exempt Puerto Rico from the Jones Act. McCain has done four different bites at the apple over the years, trying full repeals, trying partial exemptions or whatever. And it's a great example. I mean, right now you have the Jones Act for a moment was so unpopular that you had everyone, you know, Joy Reid on MSNBC was talking about how it's, you know, it's an imperative to get rid of this protectionist piece of legislation. Like, all right, let's we got something we can work with here. And yet it persists. No one has come up with an intellectual defense of the Jones Act, as far as I can tell, in decades. Reason has written, I don't know, 5,000-6,000 articles about it over the years. Yet it still persists. And that's a teachable lesson about how difficult it is to change a crappy law that has very, very concentrated benefits to people who can lobby. It's a damn shame that it took so long for the president to waive the Jones Act just for 10 days for Puerto Rico when he did it immediately, as far as I know, for Texas and Houston, or Texas and Florida. And it's even a damner shame that in the wake of this, you can't just repeal the damn thing. It is awful. And it is sadly very Trumpian. It's a mercantilist 19th century style act that doesn't work at all. And it fits perfectly with his worldview. And that's a damn shame. We should be using this as a teachable moment of thinking about all the stupid ass backwards types of laws that we have on the books that affect Puerto Rico and affect our entire lives, stretching out in a bunch of different ways, and sugar subsidies in Florida, whatever. All of these things hurt the poor people of Puerto Rico first and hardest. And hopefully we'll have the opportunity to be making those cases going forward, because Puerto Rico just got totally leveled. Every single corner of the island is screwed. They got really hammered.
The other thing here is that that should be a discrete, concrete reform proposal that can be considered in isolation, right? I mean, this is the same with the sugar subsidies. It seems like this should have been a modest ask to say, okay, let's waive it, let's think about repealing it, rather than let's just dump billions of dollars with minimal mandates and hope for the best. Like, turns out that request is very easy to fulfill in a way that, again, what should be, okay, literally just take these words, take them off the books. No one even wants to defend them. Joy freaking Reid says, let's just do it. And it, as Matt says, it's a lesson in how Washington works, that it is very, very easy to spend tens of billions of dollars that we don't have. And it is nearly impossible to eliminate a narrow law that is minimally interwoven with other aspects of our law and could be easily extricated for purposes of humanitarian good in a bipartisan way.
When I was working for congressmen in on the Hill, one of them was from the Pennsylvania delegation, and there's a law in the books that any U.S. military base has to use American anthracite coal, because anthracite coal is located abundantly in Pennsylvania. So like Kaiserslautern in Germany, where there's a U.S. installation there, they could get coal from down the street much, much cheaper, but they have to get it out of Pennsylvania. And it just sort of keeps the local economy afloat in a lot of these mining towns. But it's very much
because those benefit. Mining towns, yeah, those mining towns are really doing well.
Yeah, they're doing great.
The last thing you want to do is shut down the thriving anthracite coal industry. And, you know, and now I come from a bituminous coal family.
Oh, well, I'm a team
you know,
anthracite.
I'm already, I fuck that. You know,
well, so,
it's like the Beatles and Rolling Stones.
But with that one, though, I can at least point to who the constituency is that's pushing for this protectionist legislation. With something like the Jones Act, like, there's like a shippers union, or is it the merchant marines? Like, and who are they?
I mean, it's the American shipping industry because the way that it works is that goods transported between any two American ports. So foreign countries can bring stuff to Puerto Rico, and they pay various types of import duties and stuff
right.
like that. But it's between U.S. ports, two U.S. ports. It has to be done by U.S. flagged ships, which also are going to be mostly U.S. Manned ships as well, and it's more expensive. And of course, you know, this is one of the things that people are the U.S. Virgin Islands are exempt from it. That's about the only thing, the only part, yeah, because they're who knows why, you know, because this law was passed in 1920.
They had some lobbyists that managed to get them exempted. Well done.
Yep. But you know, one of the realities of trade, which people always forget about, is that, you know, geography is one of the great dictators of trade. And so, you know, there was a huge flap in, you know, back in the 80s when Ronald Reagan couldn't name that Canada was America at that time was Canada's biggest trading partner, was America's biggest trading partner. But like, you always end up doing more business with people who are nearby. So that's one of the ways in which Puerto Rico is held captive to this, because, you know, they're not adjacent to the United States, but they're pretty close. And they're also certainly not going to be doing a lot of business with Cuba, both because it's illegal for American entities to do that, and also because Cuba doesn't have that much to trade for different reasons. But yeah, there are certain things. I mean, like, you know, I guess it's people like Rand Paul have talked about this as a general principle, but like the idea of sunsetting laws is kind of a good idea, because this is a 1920 act, and the origins of it were to protect the the U.S. merchant marine, which was rebuilding after World War I, where they lost a ton of boats or ships to German U-boats and whatnot. And it's kind of like, you know, the 1920s are over. I mean, the 2020s are almost over. So it's like, let's kind of, you know, pick up the law books and shake out all of the stuff that is just so old and decrepit that it makes no sense, even though, as I, Andrew, your example was, is a strong one of there are definite people who benefit from that. But it's like when you can count them on one hand, or when the U.S. Department of Agriculture has more employees than people are actually farming in America, you know, something really, you know, it's time to change things. And certainly the Jones Act is one of those instances.
Think about this. There are no cruises between New York and Florida. Think about that. There are no cruises. You think no one in New York wants to take, there's a cruise, a port, a docking thing. I could,
because we're all required by law to retire there anyway. So like, why not take a carnival ship?
I can walk 15 minutes from where I'm sitting and board a carnival ship. Just right here, Brownstone, Brooklyn.
Matt, doing like real estate on the side or something? You've been really selling your location.
Your Al Capone's church, and
it's it's pretty great. It's the real America.
It's like
Nick,
talking
you
to Gordon Lightfoot. No, I get. I mean, it's like the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald also in Brooklyn. I don't know.
But it should be. But think about how much money would be willing to go. I'd love to go up and down the East Coast, the West Coast, whatever. Just like go from San Diego to Seattle and back. That would be fun. But no, you can't. You have to go from Seattle and touch Canada and go up through Alaska. You have to go, you know, from New York. You have to go up into Canada, or you go from Florida into the Caribbean because of the freaking Jones Act, because the Carnival ships and all those ships are operated by international companies and not American companies. And that's it. So, you know, this thing was written in 1920, did not anticipate that there would be mass leisure travel on gigantic boats, because back then those boats would obviously hit icebergs and sink.
I mean, this is also true of all kinds of other regulations where something happens and then you realize that it's been sort of subtly fucking you over possibly for decades. I'm thinking of Bob Poole's work on air traffic control, where in editing the cover story of this month's issue, I learned that lots of flights take less efficient flight paths because of the way that we do air traffic control in this country, which requires them to stick close to ground-based beacons, right? We have GPS. You have GPS in your phone. Like, dogs have GPS. But we don't use that technology in an efficient way when we are planning air travel. You know, flights have to fly along the eastern seaboard instead of out over the ocean for this reason, for instance. And you just, it's something you would never know. It's something you would never think about, except for that you should just know that everywhere in the background of every single inconvenience of your life is the government making it worse every day.
Well, and yeah, with airlines, it's also, you know, there are many many rules limiting the amount of foreign ownership of domestic airlines, as if there really are anything such as only domestic and only international airlines. But that's why Virgin, which is pulling out of the its stake out of Virgin US, but you know, they have Virgin Atlantic and they have Virgin US and they have Virgin Europe and, you know, Virgin Galactic, because every country, and I Matt can correct me on this if I'm wrong, but I think it was Frank Zappa who said the two things you need for your own country is an airline, like a nationalized airline, and a beer. And he was wrong. He's at least 50% wrong, right? Because you don't need a nationalized airline. You just need somebody who wants to fly people from one place to another. But because of you know, protectionism and weird security fetishes and nationalism, again, which Trump, you know, is totally into, but it's like the idea that, you know, American Airlines can't be owned by a foreign country or by investors who reside in a foreign country, even if that would make American Airlines much better. They've got to actually become minority partners in the American subdivision of American Airlines, et cetera. And all of these countries do that, you know, on the back end as well, for the most part. But it's you know, there's so many unseen laws that fuck things up. And sometimes they're technological, sometimes they're, you know, they're nationalistic, sometimes they're hysterical about security. But, you know, they all deserve to be kind of brought out into the light of day and kind of shrivel like earthworms on the sidewalk after a rainstorm.
Hey, Matt, you had written an article, I think, on the Jones Act a few days ago, and you brought up how Marco Rubio was a very big free trade proponent up until sugar subsidies are brought in. You just mentioned McCain trying to take out the Jones Act a series of times. Who do you see as the standard? Is there a standard bearer of free trade? I mean, it might be Rand Paul, I don't know. And I'm curious, is there anybody in the Democratic Party that you think is good on free trade?
If there is, I haven't heard about it. It's possible, but I mean, we had a piece in the magazine from Delaware Dave Weigel, I think circa 2008, about the death of the free trade Democrat. Democrats retook the House in 2006 under Nancy Pelosi, and there were three main elements to that. One was like full-throated opposition to lame duck President George W. Bush's attempt to quote-unquote privatize Social Security. Another was opposition to free trade. And another one that's been totally forgotten is that they opened up the party to anti-abortion people back then. They thought they were being a little bit too narrow. So that kind of changed over time. But at that moment, that was kind of the beginning of the end of the sort of Bill Clinton, Al Gore, 1990s New Democrat approach to economics. And now, I mean, Bernie Sanders is the beating heart, economic heart of the party, or Elizabeth Warren.
But isn't like Hillary Clinton nominally free trade? I mean, between her and Trump, she was certainly the free trader.
She's nominally against free trade. She felt compelled to, I mean, she had, as a Secretary of State, she was fully throated in favor of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, whatever that's called. And then as a candidate of trying to stave off Bernie Sanders, she hemmed and hawed for a long time. And I think her final answer on it was that she was against it and had been all along, obviously, even though she once called it the gold standard.
And she did the same thing with NAFTA in the previous cycle, where she would sort of speak to a crowd of union reps and say, oh, NAFTA has done huge economic damage to this country, and then kind of out of the other corner of her mouth say, no, I mean, obviously, it's fine. And this is what's standard for the Democratic yes. Party now. Like, best case is double talk.
Right. Well, I'm afraid that the double talk is finishing. Barack Obama was the same way. He campaigned against NAFTA to Hillary's left on trade. And at the same time, once the nomination was getting secure, there were just blatantly kind of open articles comments from Obama staffers saying, oh, you know, he just said that to win the nomination. He's going to be fine once he's in there. I don't think that Democrats are going to allow their politicians to get away with that so much anymore. So it's for both basic kind of sense of fiscal discipline, acknowledgement that there's a $20 trillion debt, any kind of sense of worry about the entitlement bomb, which is it's not even a time bomb anymore. It's just a bomb happening. All of that stuff and free trade is on just a massive retreat when it comes to the two major political parties. They are in such a worse place now, both parties, than they were 10 years ago, arguably 20 years ago on this stuff. So it's a really depressing time to be alive.
Yeah, I thought we'd kind of wrap that up. Like, I sort of thought the debate on free trade versus protectionism had sort of been relegated to, you know, fringe elements of both parties, and both had kind of gotten on board with that. Apparently not. Apparently, that is the populist protectionist neo-mercantilist position is rearing. And then just as a quick follow-up, Matt, I don't know. I'm going to guess that Elizabeth Warren is not a free trader, but she occasionally extols her market knowledge as someone who loves banks, albeit small ones and that kind of thing. Is she also a raring protectionist?
I'm going to say yes without having a record in front of me, because there is no politician that I'm aware of that has her views, broad views on regulation and other things in the economy, who is a vigorous free trader. If I'm wrong, I will eat something oddly shaped live on this podcast.
Oh, I've got something for you, Matt Welch. I've got something for you. By the way, anybody who is in favor of small banks, like, has Elizabeth Warren never seen It's a Wonderful Life? And where, you know, Mr. Potter might be a piece of shit when it comes to dealing with, you know, his customers, but he's actually kind of on the up and up. But small banks are not necessarily more honest or thrifty, but then they are probably more likely to hire the Uncle Billies of the world, and you know, who just like loses large envelopes
of cash.
They're
a lot more likely to go under when there's an economic problem. They're a lot more likely to go under. Like during the Depression, there weren't any national banks in Canada that closed because they were allowed to operate across state lines, and there wasn't a distributist policy in place. Whereas in the United States, where we wanted to balkanize everything, if all of the banks in your state were in sugar, were in corn, and it went under, you were screwed, and the whole infrastructure would just bottom out.
There actually was a bank that that got prosecuted after the great bailouts of 2008, 2009, which was a small bank called Abacus that catered to Chinese Americans in New York's Chinatown. And it's a fantastic example of, you know, they made some mistakes, probably because they were small. They had a sort of a couple of people inside the bank who were taking kickbacks, essentially. They reported that to their regulator. And the way they tell it, they were sort of cooperating extensively with the regulator until all of a sudden they realized they were the target of the investigation, not the person who they perceived to be the wrongdoer that they had turned in. And, you know, this idea that when essentially that same behavior happens at a big bank and we bail them out, it happens at a small bank and we prosecute them almost into non-existence.
As the poet, the Nobel Prize winner for literature, Bob Dylan, once wrote, steal a little, and they call you a thief, steal a lot, and they make you king. And it's as true now as it was when he sang that on a song from Infidels, which came out in the early 1980s.
Well, as is customary on the Reason podcast, we will conclude on a Bob Dylan quote. This has been the Reason podcast. I'm Andrew Heaton. Thank you for joining us, Matt, Catherine, and Nick. Thank you for listening at home. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.